Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. And I'm today joined by Mahua Mukherjee, who is Senior Research Fellow at the OIS. And we're here to discuss the key messages that came from her paper, India Progress on its Climate Action Plan, an update in early 2022, that was published by the Institute at the end of March 2022. Mahua, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Hello, David.
Well, Mahua, why don't we start by perhaps looking back in time? You know, India issued a national climate action plan as far back as, 2008, which was, 7 years before the Paris Agreement. So at that time, solar was, of course, not competitive. So what was the climate action plan all about, and what is in it?
Well, the climate action plan at the time, the 2008 plan, represented a first attempt to think about how to weave climate concerns into India's overarching economic development priorities and strategy. So it consisted of 8 diverse national missions, and these included solar, energy efficiency, sustainable habitat, water, greening India, the Himalayan ecosystem, sustainable agriculture, and knowledge sharing and capacity building. So this was actually an early indication that climate change necessitated a cross-sectoral, whole-of-government approach that was not at all familiar to anyone at the time. The last mission, which was on knowledge sharing and capacity development, was especially important because the entire climate action plan was fully uncharted territory in 2008. The people in charge of delivering the 8 missions didn't have anywhere to go and learn how to do this. They had to embark on experimentation and learning by doing, and they were at the beginning of a very steep learning curve. So that was the thing.
So that's really interesting because it's a very kind of early kind of stage of development. So with that, how did India manage to add, 50,000 megawatts or say 50 gigawatts of solar in just 7 years between 2015 and 2022? What happened all of a sudden to kick it off?
The first thing that kicked the solar effort into high gear was when Prime Minister Modi came into office in 2014 and immediately moved away from these missions that I was just talking about to numerical targets. Specifically, he said, we will aim to have installed solar capacity of not 20 gigawatts, which was the original target, but of 100 gigawatts by 2022, of which 60 gigawatts will be ground mounted and 40 gigawatts will be decentralized or rooftop solar. That certainly caught the attention of domestic and foreign investors, not to mention the electricity departments of various states in India, as well as all the authorizing agencies at the 3 levels of government, that is central, state, and local. So the idea was to generate these massive volumes of solar energy and distribute them to every corner of the country through the electricity distribution system, the one that existed then, as shaky as it was. So to answer your question specifically of how did India manage to do it, I'd say the government introduced a set of policies that were very favorable to large renewable energy investors, including first, removing the land acquisition headache by providing sustainable, suitable land inside so-called solar parks under the public-private partnership model. Secondly, they waived or removed transmission charges to move renewable energy output all over the country. And third, they gave renewables a must-run status, which meant that developers had preferential access to the grid, even when it was congested. So that was all on the supply side. And let me just complete this by mentioning that the most important policy on the demand side was the so-called renewable purchase obligation, or the RPO, which essentially forced every large buyer of thermal electricity to also source a certain percentage of solar energy, despite its higher cost. So this was effectively creating a reliable market for all that solar generation, and investors were reassured that somebody would be buying their output. So they felt more confident about going to all the trouble and expense of investing.
Well, I have to say, Mahua, the growth of solar is certainly very impressive. But can you say something about the solar parks and how these might also have helped in reaching those record low tariffs? What was it in particular about the solar parks that attracted intense private sector competition?
That's a great question. Solar parks were partly responsible for creating a competitive bidding frenzy among private investors, and that certainly helped the government a lot in their price discovery efforts. There was a first generation of parks as far back as 2010, which created certain important learnings. Especially, they revealed that two things were essential: access to long-term low-cost financing for the private investors inside the park, and the second thing they revealed was the need for availability of transmission lines from day one that were up and running, working, and ready to carry the electricity to customers as soon as it was generated. Regarding the first one, if the private developer ended up with very expensive loans, he would just pass that on in the form of a high solar tariff. And on the second point, if the state in which the solar park was located had promised that it was building the required transmission lines, and then they weren't ready when the solar generation was ready, then developers wouldn't be able to reach the solar energy to their customers, and yet they would still have to start repaying their loans, which was a financial disaster for them, because they'd have no revenues from which to repay the loans. So remember, the solar park itself is just the production area, but that's not where the solar energy is consumed. The transmission lines are the key to getting your output to your customers, who are in the so-called load centers. So if those transmission lines aren't ready, you can't sell and get any money for your solar generation, and then you'd have a hard time repaying your loans. So bidders in the earliest parks were burned by this. And the next time you built another solar park, you could be quite sure that no one would accept your invitation to come and bid to locate their project in it, unless you made changes to the rules of the game. So the second generation, therefore, incorporated lots of learnings, and this was key to the dizzying lower costs. So you first try to arrange cheaper financing, and second, you have all the transmission requirements in place before you invite developers to come and bid, because their process of laying down the panels is much faster than the construction of transmission lines. So you have to get the sequencing right. So let me now quickly mention the second generation of parks, which were the really successful ones. And that started with one called Rewa in the state of Madhya Pradesh. Rewa's well-deserved claim to fame is that it was the first park where competitively bid solar tariffs came in lower than the cost of coal-fired power. And this was done without any government subsidies. Rewa received bids for 7,500 megawatts. When there were only 750 megawatts on offer. So there was a tenfold oversubscription from the market. The Rewa Park authorities, going through all the bids, were therefore able to choose the cheapest 750 megawatts out of all the offers, and they allocated their highly prized plots inside the park accordingly. Remember, there was no playbook for any of this decarbonization strategy. The authorities were figuring it all out and making it up as they were going along. Rewa was also the first example in India of where a private bidder inside a solar park managed to snag a customer who was geographically located several states away. This demonstrated the truly national market for solar, and it created more interest amongst the fence sitters to participate as bidders in future auctions. So one of the solar companies generating inside Rewa today sells its output to the Delhi Metro Rail Corporation.
I have to say, Mahar, I find it, you know, really interesting that you specifically mention the importance of low-cost finance and having infrastructure in place as key requirements for the growth of renewables globally, renewables in India, because that, of course, applies also to renewables globally. So it's a really interesting learning there. But in your paper, you say that the solar tariffs in competitive auctions were falling at dizzying speeds, particularly in 2017 and 2018. So perhaps can you share with our listeners a bit about what was driving that?
Yes, indeed. Solar tariffs were sometimes falling by 35 and 40% from one auction to another within the same year and even with the same bidders. 2017 and 2018 were very special years, and they left everyone scratching their heads because the cost information was well known. So people couldn't understand how bidders were coming up with these extremely low quotes that actually made no sense. In other words, the bidders would apparently be losing money if their bids were accepted. And yet this strange behavior continued in auction after auction. We need to remember two things here. First, all the equipment was coming from China at the time. So the received wisdom is that Chinese manufacturers of solar modules achieved huge economies of scale, because of both global demand and because of their own large domestic market. One thing that's less often acknowledged is that massive orders from India were in fact fueling part of those economies of scale that were pushing down prices and benefiting solar investors the world over. India, therefore, played a large role in the global outcome that solar prices reached grid parity a full decade before they were forecast to do so. And the other factor, which some Indian solar company CEOs would candidly mention in interviews, was this. They had figured out that there was about a six-month lag from the time they won the bid and they signed the contract and obtained their land clearances and construction permits, up to the time that they actually had to procure the materials from China and sign the purchase orders with their suppliers. So they were fully counting on prices coming down continuously from their Chinese suppliers. And they went ahead and took the risk of factoring in so-called anticipated price declines for their hardware when they placed the bids. One more thing contributed to the dizzying decline in solar tariffs, and that we must also not forget to mention. There were very professionally and transparently conducted e-auctions, online auctions, for which the government deserves full credit. And as I've mentioned, they had also put in investor-friendly policies such as RPOs and transmission fee waivers for renewable electricity and given it must-run status. So all of these combined to sharply reduce the competitively discovered cost of solar energy in India and in fact made it competitive with thermal power, as I've said, at least a decade before that was forecast to happen.
I have to say, I'm finding this really interesting about, you know, all these changes that were taking place and the fact that kind of within the kind of reducing costs, how bidders have actually taken advantage of that to develop these low cost kind of power energy sources and electricity generation. But in your paper, you also talk about the world's largest LED market transformation program, UJALA Energy Efficiency Program in India. So can you tell us what was it? When was it, and what was the impact?
Right. This is a very important thing, actually, the energy efficiency program. We call it the Ujala Energy Efficiency Program. So in 2015, when Ujala was launched by the Prime Minister, the LED bulb technology was new. And though it was very promising in terms of energy savings, if it was used to replace incandescent bulbs, it was still far too expensive to be mainstreamed. One LED bulb cost 800 rupees at the time, compared to about only 50 rupees for an incandescent version. So in a way, the LEDs were all dressed up but had nowhere to go. Nobody wanted them. Ujala was a market transformation initiative created by nothing more than demand aggregation. There was no subsidy involved. A procurement agency under the Central Ministry of Power got together with a few states and collected very large in-principle orders for LEDs. Manufacturers were then shown these orders and were invited to quote better prices. So they set up very large manufacturing units and achieved economies of scale because LEDs were then no longer an experimental technology, but rather a must-use product in order to attain energy efficiency goals. India also has the world's largest municipal street lighting program with LEDs, and this saves a lot of electricity bills for struggling municipalities. So in a few years, the cost of an LED bulb fell by 85%. A three-year manufacturer's warranty requirement has pushed the failure rate down to just 0.3% and created a lot of confidence in the product. So today, in Q1 of 2022, the number of LED bulbs distributed under Ujala has reached 368 million. And estimates indicate that the Ujala program in 7 years has saved nearly 50 million units of electricity per annum. So that's a pretty great energy efficiency or demand reduction achievement just through bulk purchasing.
And as you say, bulk purchasing is kind of reducing the costs down at all times. But in India, there's often kind of a conundrum talked about economic growth versus achieving climate change targets, specifically with respect to development and the climate ambitions in the country. So could you perhaps share with us and give us kind of your view about that?
Sure. The conundrum, actually, as you said, it consists of decoupling economic growth from ever-increasing greenhouse gas emissions. So India has the twofold challenge of meeting economic development goals and climate goals. There's no role model nor any historical precedent for this, because higher emissions accompanying economic growth has been the historical pattern of all rich countries up to now. Nobody's tried to grow without increasing their emissions. So India's embarking on a first. India has to decarbonize while also building massive infrastructure, including smart mega cities of the future. It's got to deliver transportation services, good jobs, safe pipe water supply, sanitation services to hundreds of millions of people. It's got to deliver education and healthcare, new farming methods, cold chains for improved agro-processing and increased farm incomes. It's got to deliver improved transportation, improved roads, bridges, flight connections, etc. And let's not forget that air conditioning will become a survival necessity as temperatures steadily climb due to global warming. So all of that investment is still ahead. So the conundrum is, how will India thread the needle between taking climate positive actions and also pursuing economic growth and increasing the standard of living of its population? It would require at least a doubling, if not a tripling, of average per capita energy consumption, because today India's per capita consumption is just a quarter of the global average. And one researcher, in fact, notes that the average American consumes as much energy in a month as the average Indian consumes in a year. So in summary then, India's unfolding climate action strategy has four parts. First, try to electrify as many things as possible so that they can eventually run on renewable energy after a transition period. Second, maximize energy efficiency, so you need as little electricity as possible. And third, simultaneously work on increasing the share of renewables in your grid. This creates a path to first reducing the growth rate of emissions, then peaking, plateauing, and decreasing emissions, and eventually achieving net zero. Last but not least, the fourth prong of the strategy is to start on a path to digitizing your electric utilities and moving to smart metering in order to be able to track every last unit of electricity and adapt your system. So India, through continuous experimentation with these approaches and always fine-tuning and building on lessons learned, as in the case of solar parks and the Ujala program, will need to find its own formula for decoupling economic growth from ever-increasing greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay, Mahua, let's just kind of change the discussion a little bit towards kind of the financing side of these programs, because we often hear that the long-term low interest rate financing of local currency is essential in order to increase the rate of solar technology adoption. So can you perhaps explain to our listeners, how does that work? And what is the connection between interest rate of a loan and the solar tariff?
Well, this is actually fascinating, and I wish we had more time to go into this, but because when you have a renewable technology like solar, where there's no fuel involved because sunshine is free, the only thing you're actually doing as a solar developer is taking a loan to buy the hardware, and that is asset financing, pure and simple. You put this hardware in the sunshine and you get paid for selling the electricity that happens as a result. So what should you charge? What's a fair price to charge for that electricity? Well, let's look at your costs. Your biggest cost is repayment of the loan that you took to buy the panels. That's your debt service. You don't have any fuel cost. You have a small operating cost because you need to pay someone every now and then to clean your panels and tighten the cables. And there are a few other items like remote monitoring of how you're making sure your panels are working, but let's bundle those in with the operating cost. So you just need to make sure that you earn enough money from selling the electricity that will allow you to pay back your loan and pay your operating costs. So think of two solar developers with similar projects. One has a very short loan maturity with a high interest rate. He has to repay the entire principal in, let's say, 5 years. So his principal installments are high, and on top of that, he has a high interest rate. So his debt service burden is very high. The other developer has a concessional loan. He has 20 years to repay the amount he borrowed, and the interest rate, which is always applied to the unpaid balance, is also low. So his debt service burden, or the money he has to give to the bank every month, is relatively low. And let's assume all else is equal and cancels out. So the solar developer with the high debt service burden needs to sell his electricity for a high unit price. That's because he has to pay a high amount to the bank every month, corresponding to his expensive loan. Because this is project finance, the only relevant source of funding for the lender comes from the solar electricity sales. So this first developer needs to make sure that he creates a high enough revenue stream every month, most of which then goes to his lender to repay his loan. This means his poor old customer has to pay him a very high unit cost of electricity, but that customer can also refuse to buy such expensive electricity and can choose to just stay with cheaper thermal power. If that happens, the developer and his banker are both in trouble, because the revenues would stop coming in if the customers just desert renewable energy because it's too expensive. Now, the other developer, which has a low cost of finance, meaning he has a cheaper loan, can be much more relaxed and he can charge a low solar tariff. He can get away with asking for lower revenues from his customers, who therefore have affordable solar energy. They're not likely to desert him. He can repay his lower debt service from these revenues, and he'll still have adequate money to pay his operating costs and his own required rate of return. So his solar energy is much more affordable, and he has a lot more customers buying from him. This is why developing countries are crying themselves hoarse, wondering where the concessional finance will come from, as promised under the Paris Agreement, in order to make renewable energy affordable and let it go mainstream in all of their countries. We should also remember that if the cost of the hardware falls, as it was doing in 2017 and 18, because of Chinese economies of scale, that's another way for developers to enjoy lower debt service, because the size of the loans they have to take keeps shrinking as the underlying asset cost of the hardware, the panels, keeps going down. So that happened, and interest rates also came down. That was in those last few years. Interest rates were at record lows, if you remember, globally. And loan maturities lengthened. So it all worked out to a golden combination where solar unit costs fell quickly below thermal power unit costs.
Well, I have to say, I find that answer to that question absolutely fascinating, Mahoya. It just really kind of sets out so clearly some of the challenges on funding these kind of infrastructure projects. We talked about solar, but it could apply to many other infrastructure projects. But unfortunately, we're getting to the end of our time for the podcast. And as I think all our listeners know, I like to end a podcast with a forward-looking question. So what would you say are the prospects for India to achieve its 2030 climate action targets? And what are the challenges and risks our listeners should look out for? And perhaps a personal view, you know, are you confident that they will be well managed?
Well, thanks for this final question. India's stated ambition is to grow its $2.7 trillion economy of today to $5 trillion US dollars by 2026, fiscal year 26. But this has undoubtedly been dealt a large setback by the COVID-19 pandemic that brought the country to a near standstill twice in 2020 and 21. So the new target date for a $5 trillion economy may realistically be closer to 2030 than 25. Can this giant leap be made while also shifting to renewables and reducing a billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, as the Prime Minister announced at COP26 in Glasgow? On balance, given the remarkable growth of the sector in the 5 years before the COVID pandemic, and the continued growth during 2020 and 21, despite very difficult circumstances, I personally believe that there is reason for optimism that India's 2030 climate goals will be met either on schedule or very close to schedule. Why do I think so? Because today, as we speak, there are already over 100 gigawatts of renewable energy commissioned in India, and this rises to 150 gigawatts, actually, if you include large hydro. Solar alone has crossed the 50 gigawatt mark in just 7 years. So yes, I think that if the government continues with supportive policies and investment frameworks, the capital is certainly out there somewhere in the world, both domestic and international, and will find its way to renewable projects in India. Let me mention some of the challenges and the risks, as you asked about. I'd say there are at least three things to watch out for that are within the government's control, and there's one thing that is absolutely outside the government's control. The first three would be, first, funding for adaptation investment. Second, carefully managing the issue of land scarcity and competing uses of land. And third, how quickly the state-owned electric utilities can improve their performance and actually step up to the task of dealing with distributing renewables. The first one on adaptation is something we don't talk about enough. Whether there'll be enough grant money directed to making adaptation investments to protect the most vulnerable groups from climate and global warming disasters and restore their livelihoods at the earliest. So that needs grant money because that doesn't generate any revenues. So no one will lend you for that because they don't see any repayment coming from that. So where will the grant money come from? That's question one for adaptation. The second risk is the scarcity of land in a country of 1.3 billion people. Every inch of land has many competing uses. Large solar parks and wind farms will require lots of land, and they'll need to push out other activities if such huge generation capacities are to be met. And how long will public support be sustained for this disappearance of large swathes of land under solar panels? So that has to be managed carefully. And the third risk is whether the distribution utilities in some states, which are financially and technically in very shaky condition, are going to be up to the task of taking in so much intermittent renewable energy and distributing it while pushing out an ever larger share of the coal-fired power that they mostly distribute today. Can those distribution utilities modernize fast enough? They will need to be the workhorses that distribute the renewable energy under the Electrify Everything strategy, and they need to be digitized, smart, and ready. So that's the third risk. These risks are well understood by the authorities, and they're all up to the task. So barring any other global shocks like COVID-19, I think we are well set to recover and get back on track. But that's not all. I had mentioned that there was one big risk that was not up to Indian policymakers. And that is from global macroeconomic events and interest rate policy shifts that will be decided in Europe and the USA based on their domestic inflation fighting requirements. So the risk works like this. A sharp increase in interest rates in the US, for example, which is already being talked about, can suck out huge volumes of foreign capital overnight from emerging markets like India. And it can suddenly leave a lot of projects without funding, languishing on the drawing board. So the annual renewable energy investment requirement has been estimated to be $26 billion in order to reach the 500 gigawatt goal by 2030. The government is putting in $10 billion of this per year. The rest depends on market conditions and private investor appetites. So we have to hope for the best, that the private money will be there in response to India's sound framework for investments, and that the climate targets will be met on schedule. The government is certainly doing its level best. Otherwise, given some interest rate blips and so on, there might be a delay of a few years after 2030 to reach 500 gigawatts. But I say this is a Herculean task, and the effort just has to be sustained. As we were saying earlier, this is an unprecedented effort to pursue 8 to 9% growth annually, build millions of things that are not in place yet, and decarbonize at the same time.
Well, Mira, thank you very much for sharing so much of your time today. As always, I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from your paper, India's Progress on its Climate Action Plan, an update in early 2022. And this paper was published at the end of March 2022 and is available on the OIES website. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org. Thank you.